Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series 4 of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. For now though, sit back, relax, and let's take things from here. This week, I am joined by George Zafaris, one of the directors at Molecule to Market. And as always, joining me as co-host, we have Adam Walker, independent biometrics expert. George, Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, James. Glad to be here, mate.
Good stuff, good stuff. Well, look, George, I guess just hearing the glad to be here, mate, that is a little bit of an indication as to the accent there. Look, if you can perhaps give our audience a quick intro in your own words of, yeah, who you are, your role, and what Molecule to Market is all about.
Yeah, so who I am is an Australian living in the US for quite some time. I started in the industry 21 years ago as an intern at Bristol Myers Squibb. I think I was 21 at the time, so it's quite some time ago. And then after college, I joined PPD, and that's where I really learned the ropes of what it was to be in the service side of the pharmaceutical industry at a big CRO. I was there for 13 years, and it was really, really good experience. Through that, I had 8 different promotions. So when I left there as an associate director of PM, I'd worked a lot of different roles. The main life thing that PPD offered was they were really flexible in where you wanted to work. So when I became a CRA and trained at PPD, we did what was called a foundations program, and you spent 8 days, so 1.5 weeks, in one of the main training facilities. So for me, I went to Raleigh-Durham, the RTP office. I spent 1.5 weeks there and really liked it. And that was in 2004. So I went back home to Melbourne, and I said to my manager at the time, hey, can I move to America? Or the other training center was in Cambridge in the UK. It's like, can I move to one of these? And she was like, yeah, we can work on that. What are you thinking? And I was like, well, when I become a senior CRA, I'll probably have enough experience. I'd always lived at home in Melbourne for my whole life, never moved away, never done really anything. I didn't take any gap year, so this was kind of a way to experience the world and while I was getting paid. And we ended up, I moved to Wilmington in North Carolina, which was PPD's headquarters. And I've been in the US for most of the time since 2006. I did take a break to live at home back in Melbourne in 2011 for the year. And then after PPD, I joined a biotech company, and they gave me the opportunity to move back to Australia with my then family for about 3.5 years. We came back to the US right in between COVID. That was really not a great time to move, but had we not, we probably would have been still stuck in Melbourne because they had an extreme amount of lockdowns in how they managed COVID. But while I was there, right at the end, all through my career, I've always looked for ways to identify gaps, like just the gaps in my skill set. What haven't I done? PPD did all their phase one work in Austin. So if you weren't in Austin, you didn't get phase one experience. So I had a massive amount of phase two and global phase three experience, no phase one. And I was like, I got to get that. And the best way I found to do that was to become a contractor. So I became a contractor, got a phase one study to monitor that. And then I had to move back. We found that we had to move back to the US. So I was going to give up that contract. And at the time, I'd met a company called Pure CDM. They're an Australian company that focused just on data management. And I asked him, I was like, do you know anyone like you who just focuses on doing clinical research and project management really well? And Helen Palivu put me in touch with Anne DeLuca and Robin Hanson, who are the co-directors at Molecule to Market. And I really enjoyed meeting them. I had two contracts. Unfortunately, my clients at the time didn't choose them. I don't particularly know why. I think they really just wanted to work with a one-person contractor consultant like I was. But I kept in touch with Anne and Robin, found myself needing to add Australia as a COVID mitigation strategy on a study I was working on around June 2020. So I reached back out and I said, do you guys want to have a look at this for us? This client is San Francisco Biotech. They're really into partnering. They have the right style of client that I know you like. And Molecule to Market won that business, and we kept in touch. And again, I kind of found a I want to do something. What haven't I done? And I really haven't used my MBA that I managed to obtain part-time as much as I wanted to. So I reached out to Anne and Robin and said, I'm thinking about starting my own CRO. I know you guys did it. What do you recommend? Like, what's your number one piece of advice? And they were like, number one is don't do it alone. That's all they said. Do not do it by yourself, because it's like, not only is it really hard and you'll be really lonely when it's in the hard times, when you do find the right rhythm and things to celebrate, you don't have anyone to celebrate it with. So that stuck with me, and we were just chatting and talking, and they came to me a little bit later. It was like, well, we know you're wanting to do this. How about we do it together? Like, you launch a CRO, but use our expertise that we've gathered on how to do this unique service orientated with really experienced personnel CRO from Australia, and let's try replicate that format as well as we can in the US. Because Australia has had a good run, almost a decade's worth of bringing clients into Australia for phase one studies, mostly because of the research and tax development incentive that offers like 43.5% refund. But it's also that the timelines are better than the US was. So you had a time and cost benefit. With all those studies coming in, a lot of experience, you got a lot of quality clinics in phase one. But and the relationship can't really pass on to phase two because the Australian population isn't big enough mm-hmm. for most therapeutic areas to support a phase two study. So
you kind of started out as a CRA and progressed through the ranks a little bit to the point where you're like, you know, hey, I've built up enough experience here. You know, I'd quite like to get involved in this. Yeah. World myself, but actually start my own CRO. Look, just for I guess the audience and for me, I guess probably a question to both of you really. Look, what is step one of actually setting up a CRO? You know, other than, you know, just naming it, but you know, what is that first step?
For me, it was trying to think of what I wanted to do that. There's, because it's such a highly regulated industry, it's hard to differentiate yourself. And it was coming up with a plan of differentiation that other CROs aren't offering. So that's what Molecule to Market offered as an attractiveness, was that they have experienced leaders. Anne, Robin and I all have over 20 years experience. All the project managers are over 15 years, most of them close to 20. And then we're really looking at people with double digits experience to work in the company. So that's, I thought that was enough of a differentiator that it isn't available in the market in the US to try it here. It's looking for the jumping off point that you can attract clients. That's what was it for me. I hope I'm right, but this is my first time. I know Adam's done it a couple more times than me.
There's no right or wrong, but yeah, I mean, the way you explain it is is fascinating, George, from your perspective with regards to that US Australia piece. And I think to your question, James, you know, where do you start? The reason I've never set up a CRO myself and the reason I'm still an independent consultant is primarily because it's a bit like the chicken and egg situation. Either you win the contract and you write the SOPs and you get your validation sorted and you get your preferred provider arrangements in place and you've got those key skills in-house, and there's only so much that one can do as an individual, isn't there, George? That's it. Or you just go for it and you just say, I'm going to give this next 12, 18 months my time and I've got some cash in the bank and I'm just going to go for it and I'm going to commit to deliver and I will smash down every door and get that first contract and justify having spent the last year writing SOPs, bringing in people, literally, you know, mortgaging your house against it. I'm pointing in the direction of my house. That's why I haven't done it. But that's not to say it can't be done, James, because it, you know, clearly George is a, you know, early doors in that. But you need, you know, the financial backing that you described, George, I think is also quite pivotal, because in this industry, you know, you work alongside some really, really smart people, but there are also some very smart, wealthy people that want to back someone and put their money on their horse, right? And it sounds like that's what these guys have done for you, George.
Yeah, Anne and Robin have really focused on just their business in Australia and New Zealand for 10 years, full time. They were doing this for 2 years before that, getting everything set up for Molecule to market in Australia. So their wealth of experience in already having all those SOPs written, and all we have to do now is tweak them slightly for the US, is great. And they've reinvested all of that money into Molecule to Market. And now they've decided, they've been waiting for an opportunity that looked well, like, because they've put in full trust in me, which is an amazing feeling for me, because this is what I was looking for as well. That entrepreneurial opportunity that where the blood, sweat and tears of 21 years of that can be put into effect. And we're still finding ourselves in the chicken and egg situation, but Anne and Robin have pushed me towards the just go for it. The clients will come. Like, all I've been focused on since I spoke to James last is speaking to potential employees. Like, what team can I bring together? How can we bring them together? If we get them, we'll get a client. And the clients are looking for that as well. Like, the difficulty in them signing with a consultant is, who's the consultant's backup?
They don't want to be first either. They never want to be the first one. They never want to be your first client, do they? Yeah. You know, show me three references from three other companies that you've done work with for the last 12, 18 months. No one wants to be number one. So you just never tell them you're number one.
We actually had someone approach us to do work in Australia because they'd done work with Robin and Anne a long time ago and through another partner. And then they heard about us being a subsidiary in the US. We launched on June the 1st. And they were like, well, actually, we have two investigators also in the US. Let's add that into the proposal. So it does offer that benefit of you overcome that being the first one, because, well, it's just an add-on. And it's not as big of a hurdle to jump. Than if you're just an add-on to another company that's been in existence.
It sounds like a tough gig just hearing you both explain this about, like, you've got to have all of that expertise, all of that reputation, but then nobody gets that until you've started doing stuff. So it's quite a, yeah, as you say, it's that chicken and egg situation. So, I mean, rightly so, George, you should feel pleased that Robin and Anne have, you know, put their faith in you to back you to do this. Look, I guess I'm always interested, I guess, as a business owner and a recruitment consultant, in the makeup of people as to what makes others back people. So what would you say, I mean, without blowing your own trumpet too much, you know, what do you think it is that you have that they've seen in yourself? Because you probably have never like reflected on this. A lot of us don't, because we don't like to, as I say, blow our own trumpets too much. But what do you think that they've seen in you? And what do you think other CRO leaders, anyone thinking about this, would need to have?
I think Adam will find this pretty funny. And Robin and Adam actually told me one of the first things was that they really thought I was a good business planner. I was like, how hard I negotiated with them on a contract that wasn't even mine, because I was outsourcing, like I was subcontracting a portion of our agreement between the client to them to diversify our risk. Mm. And they were like, how particular I was in my line-by-line itemized and detailed review of the budget, the questions I asked. Like, I'd learned a lot on the tricks of the trade and how to use them in my favor. Mm. But also being able to understand that you can use them, honestly, on either side of the fence, you can use them in your favor, because there's some industry standards that we're looking to shake up as well. A lot of CROs will add hours into a budget where clients won't ask questions about, and they're like, they know that that's going to be great. That's where they're going to make up the money. But what we try to focus on now, and we've had to defend this against the client just last week, is where do we spend our time? Like, let's not hide it. I was like, a monitoring visit is a monitoring visit, and it takes a lot more than 6 hours of travel. Like, especially in this day and age, if you've tried to get anywhere in the US, you're lucky to get there in 6 hours, even if it's one flight, like just going. So we increased our monitoring visit unit in particular, and the client asked a question on it, and we defended it in that that's where we'll spend that amount of time there. So we feel like we should charge you for it. But where we won't spend amount of time, where other CROs will boost the budget to try and make up for losing money on monitoring visits, is in site management or clinical trial management. Like, you have a project manager, why do you need to add in site management? So extreme amount of site management costs and extreme amount of clinical management costs. Our budget is lighter on that side, because we're charging realistic amount of time for what we're doing. So that's really what we're looking at.
We are so closely aligned on this point, George, because similarly, having sat on both sides of the fence, whether it be a CRO or a pharma, you know the tricks that they play, you know the line items that go into a proposal that are always fat. And some companies, I'm not going to mention any names at this point, but some companies will have a project management line that will vary from anywhere between 25% of contract value down to maybe 12.5%, 10%. And that's kind of their moving bar with regards to, you know, where they make their bucks, basically, isn't it? And unless you know that, you would never ask the question. Or you ask a simple question around, well, so how many hours do you mean when you say this many, this activity? You know, what goes behind that proposal? In other words, what's in your spreadsheet behind the scenes, the under the bonnet piece that you're not showing me? Because unless you've put those costs together and you've done those assessments and understand the nuts and bolts of it, and this is where we're coming to, James, you know, unless you've been on both sides of that fence, you're really going in blind. And so therefore it's a bit of a finger in the air, isn't it? And unless this is what they've seen in you clearly, George, you know, you can scrutinize and challenge costs and proposals and activities because you've done it. And you can only do that if you've done it. You can't blag those things.
And the other thing was just the gut feeling. Like, you just got to go with your gut sometimes. And Anne and Robin, they're like on the other side of the world pretty much from me. And I think having the Australian connection helped a lot. They knew about me in Melbourne already, so it wasn't like a brand new entity to them. But they joke with me as well, like, why did you pick us? It's not just them picking me. It's like, I could have gone by myself, or I could have found someone else to do this with. So it was about having the right gut feeling on, this is something that's worthwhile in pursuing. I'm pretty sure it's going to work. As much experience that we have in behind us, but we also we like to have a little bit of fun as well. So that's a uniqueness that you kind of a lot of I would say most CROs lose that in senior management is people who can still have fun and can still be relatable, and that's one thing we'll never lose.
Well, I think that's, I guess, kind of brings me on to where I was going to go with that. I thought that you might mention kind of your work ethic. Again, a lot of people sometimes overlook their own work ethic. I know that just having interviewed Adam about his own background on this very podcast, the amount of hours and work that he used to put himself in, you know, it drove him to burnout.
For someone else, exactly.
But, you know, when you and I first connected, and Adam, I'll share this with you, you know, George was heading to Bio, the conference, and he told me that he'd been up till like 3 in the morning most evenings, you know.
No, yeah, just one night.
And he said that he hadn't worked, you know, that hard since, you know, being a CRA in his 20s. I was just like, how do you do that? You know, I'm up early, but there's no way I'm going to bed that late. So I thought that would have been sort of one of the things. But again, it shows that you can also enjoy what you do, but have fun with it.
Yeah, it was a lot of that, I think. And it didn't feel like work. I definitely get told a lot that I have this weirdness of consistent of work, like the amount of hours I can do for quite a significant period of time. Like I do get tired, my batteries run out, my patience runs out, but like I can keep it pretty high level for a long period of time. So like I remember when I first moved to the US, I had roommates and they actually thought I was on some sort of stimulant, either legal or prescribed or not legal, how hard I was working, because I would be gone before they were up. I would get home after they'd gone to bed. Most of it was work, or it was like just out with friends and trying to have some balance. And they just didn't understand how I could survive off such little sleep. And I can't do it forever, but I did do it a lot in my 20s, because long term, I just knew from my family, like how many hours my dad worked when we were young kids. And it did slow down later on, but he was working all the time.
That's where you got some of your work ethic from then, you know,
definitely.
Your dad. What did he do out of interest?
When we were young, he ran gas stations in the US, service stations or whatever you'd call them everywhere else.
Yeah.
So it was like every day. Before 6 a.m. he was opening, and he was not closing until 10 o'clock every day. The funnest thing for us was to go to work and visit with him, and like when we got old enough, it was like helping count the till at the end of the day when he had to cash things out. But yeah, just seeing that, but also knowing that it wasn't healthy that he was doing that with all, my mom had 4 kids, the main 3 sisters. So I kind of was like always looking at lessons learned. I was like, it's great to have a huge work ethic, but balance it with having something else, but balance it and do it when you don't have as many outside responsibilities. So I chose my 20s to just smash out as much work as I could. I would, and especially Adam would know this in the CRO world, like the big CRO, you have to get promoted, you basically have to be doing your job and the next job for a certain period of time. And then they just switch your title.
Yep.
And then maybe you have to do the old one for a little bit longer because they can't find anyone to take that work. But you just, I would go out and monitor, do my CRA work. I distinctly remember flying home from Memphis, going straight to the office, not going home, to review reports that my CRA, because I was a lead CRA, other CRAs had submitted, just to make sure that our milestones and our timelines weren't being met. Like I wasn't, they had submitted on time. I was like, I was going to meet my timeline of reviewing on time so we could finalize with the client. And that's what I did for a very long time. But it's interesting now, my wife, she never saw any of that. Like we met early 30s. And she, now she thinks like, I don't really work. So, like you just talk to people all the time and just sit on your computer, take meetings, don't listen. I was like, no, I listen. It was great. It was worth it. It was an investment into my family life in the early days, and I wouldn't change it at all.
Amazing. So let's talk about Molecule to Market then. So look, you are looking to get, you know, set up, win some clients. What is the specific focus, you know, therapy that you're focusing on? Is there a particular phase? Where are you looking to try and connect with people? And I guess, yeah, what would you say is that USP? I mean, you mentioned earlier that pretty much all of your staff have at least 15, 20 plus years of experience, which is pretty unheard of when I'm speaking to most clients. And yeah, to try and maintain that is going to be tough. So look, talk us about the roadmap. What do things look like? And what's the purpose for Molecule to Market?
Yeah, I'll answer the easy parts of your question first. We're definitely focused on phase two.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main business problem we were trying to solve for current clients going to Australia for phase one work is what's the easiest way for them to maintain a relationship with the same CRO without making it too problematic? It was like, add one of the largest populations with the same language that we can. So we added the US.
Mm-hmm.
So that's phase two is where we're focused on. It is going to be difficult. We do not plan to maintain the Australian entities' experience that they do provide. We will only hire the best people we can. And what we're looking to do is hire people we know or from people that we trust. So I am already hiring or looking to hire someone who I brought into the industry about a year ago. And she's been amazing. She came to us from Peloton. Peloton wanted her to move to Austin, which was lucky because she'd probably not have a job right now. And she didn't want to move. She would like the remote work. She's a physical therapist or physiotherapist by schooling, but never really wanted to deal in the clinic setting. Did a lot of research about the industry, thought it suited her. And it suits her perfectly. And she's only got 12 to 18 months experience, but I've known her for that long. So that's kind of where we're going to look at, because it would be impossible to replicate what the Australian team has been able to do in the US. And in regards to therapeutic area, we are really not limiting ourselves. I wouldn't say we're therapeutic agnostic. We're going to just focus on things that we're passionate about amongst the directors.
Mm-hmm.
Or our team has an extreme amount of experience with. For me, I have a wide range of experience. But my three passions, well, underlying passion would be pediatric research. That's why I joined Padeon, which became Premier. And it's just amazing to be able to do research with kids.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are in pediatric research are just make it so worthwhile. And the things that you can do to change the young kids' lives. But pediatric isn't really a therapeutic area. So within that, I've done mostly immunotherapy work. Early days, I worked with MedImmune on their RSV immunotherapy injection, which was palivizumab, and then that's became the gold standard. So that was like one of the first studies I worked on. And then one of the last studies I worked on, which was a Takeda dengue vaccine study that is just being approved recently. So pediatric has been great, but I started in oncology, so we know we can do that. And that's Anne's passion for research, so we share that. When I moved to Axsome Therapeutics and worked on the biotech on the client side, I worked in neurology CNS, and that just coincides with Robin's passion. She was a stroke nurse to begin with in her first career, and now she's in research. And in between both of those, I did infectious diseases, and that would be something else that we would look at. So we're just focus on our passions, focus on things we can do really well. And I think I've mentioned before, there's other things we could look at, but if we don't have like 3 to 5 years experience or multiple trials in a particular therapeutic area, and even if you look at oncology, you have to break it down and every trial would be different. Like we might take some oncology studies because it's very similar to things we've done, but there's oncology is so vast, there'd be other things that we would have to say no to because we wouldn't have the experience to do that. I think I covered all of your questions. I'm not quite sure though.
So, I asked too many, but Adam, you looked like you were going to interject there.
Yeah, I think I was just going to follow on from your question really, James, which is really, I think, to the point that George is making, which is really, if you can do it, you can do it in anything, can't you, George? You know, it's not necessarily, you know, if you've done oncology, you can do anything. If you've done early phase, you can do anything. And I think from a recruitment point of view, James, you know, it's important that, you know, anyone listening to this gets their skills early doors, commits, gets as much under their belt as they can as early as possible, in a similar way to the way George has. You know, if you get that exposure, the broad exposure to different therapeutic areas, the principles are the same. You know, protocol always follows the same process. We always have a schedule of assessments. There are recurring visits, recurring forms that happen, whether you're a data manager, a CRA, a medic, a PI. We all follow the same set of rules every time.
That's interesting, because you know what? I guess my experience, I guess, sitting my side of the table and dealing with CROs as clients, and when I'm speaking to applicants, job seekers, etc., my advice is normally to specialize first to get the experience and then to generalize. Because normally, if a client comes to me and they're considering someone with, you know, a year, 2 years experience, they want it in the area that they have focused. So yeah, no, it's interesting that I guess perhaps, George, where you've been there, you've done it, and you've got such a wealth of experience, you've reached that generalized phase, and you can do that. But no, it's just interesting to hear your views on that from both of you, because yeah, from what I see sometimes my side of the table, it's slightly different, I guess. But hey, I guess that's why it's good to talk about these things, I guess.
I definitely look for generalists when I'm recruiting. I don't know about you, George. What do you think?
I think it depends. Like I agree with you, Adam, and you don't hear it often. It's like, and it probably starts with oncology. Like if you can do oncology and that's what you do first, and not many people get to do it first. Mm. I was very lucky just to get that opportunity. I think that sets you up to move into other therapeutics very easily. And I also agree with you, James, that like clients are like, unless they have like a really difficult therapeutic area experience and they know that they could probably do other things that are, they're not a lot simpler. People will say CNS is a lot easier or infectious disease is a lot easier. It really isn't. Mm. I thought it would be, but it wasn't. Like you can make protocols really difficult if you want to. But the clients, like, yeah, so unless you have that difficult therapeutic area, they're not willing to give the chance to someone with 1 to 2 years experience, unless it's in what they are looking for. Like you see it all the time. Like one that comes up a lot is ophthalmology studies. There's like a unique niche for it. And it's always one is like, if you have this experience, please apply. I've seen that a lot. But like, I don't get it either. It's like, I honestly think anyone could do those studies if they've done, if they've got 2 to 3 years experience in a different therapeutic area. Like the minimum amount of stuff they would have to learn could definitely be learned in the first 3 to 4 weeks. Instead of doing reading SOPs that you already know, you focus on therapeutic training on what they should know for that area, because the rules are all the same. And that's why I like being in the industry. It's like there's not hardly any gray, and there's like you follow step-by-step processes. If you have any questions, you can definitely look up the answer, or you can find someone who can help you look up the answer. So I think it is in the middle, and it depends on the unique situation with what the person, what experience they do have. I think you are also asked if I was going to give advice, and I have given this before, is people with about a year's worth of experience, and this might not happen as much, but it happened during COVID quite a bit. They got offered the opportunity to go into oncology, and I told them to take it. But you also have to be careful, because you don't want to be siloed and just do oncology forever if you don't want to. Mm. Very difficult as soon as you get that experience to get out of it, because it's like so highly regarded. So take the opportunity to get it, but just be careful, because if you don't like it, but other people think you're good at it, you're going to stay there for quite some time. But it's learning something that's difficult early on will help you become a generalist much quicker, I think.
Amazing. I absolutely agree with your point. The other thing I was just going to follow on from that, George, was with regards to the pediatrics, and have you come into contact with rare diseases and that kind of space, because that's also huge. And without selling myself short, a lot of what we learn in clinical research is actually so transferable to rare disease, isn't it? Where you have very small patient populations, invariably pediatrics, but also very light requirements around regulations. I just would love to hear your thoughts around that.
Because most rare diseases impact pediatrics, so it comes up a lot. I really enjoyed just kind of looking at the phases of what the industry is focused on, especially from the CRO point of view. You did see about 5 to 8 years ago a big push to supporting biotechs, and that's when the big CROs came out with their biotech arms. They all call them pretty much the same thing. And then after that, in the last, and it's still extremely important, but about 2 years ago, rare disease came up, and it was like a lot of money, well-deserved, going into the area. Going back to what I said, is like, experience-wise, I've worked on rare disease studies. It's not a significant amount of experience where we would be like, yes, we can do that. But it does, the principles of good research in other therapeutic areas specifically apply. And you do have a lot of flexibility as well, because you have such a minimum amount of potential participants that you have to pull out these stops that you would never do on other studies.
Exactly.
You would be like, okay, it's not a problem to bring this patient up from anywhere in South America if you want to, and treat them for 4 weeks in Houston.
Wow.
I was like, what? I was like, yep, that's what we do in rare disease. It's like but one thing I did see it was great to see from the FDA as well, despite there being a significant need in finding treatments for this mostly unmet treatment group is if your safety work in a protocol is not to standard, it doesn't matter whether you're treating 5 patients or 500, the FDA is gonna be like, no, They put a study or a program I was working on hold because the safety data wasn't as robust as the client thought they had. And we needed to tighten up what we were doing during the study and adding a specific nephrology test, adding a couple other things in to just moving things up as well to do the safety testing a little bit earlier with the pediatric group, because one of the unique things in pediatrics is that always comes up is blood sampling. It's like, how many times are you going to bleed my baby? How much blood are you going to take? Like it's nowhere near as, it hardly ever comes up on an adult study, unless you're going to look at taking hundreds of milliliters, which you don't. So the pediatric safety study, you're always trying to balance that as like not taking too much blood from this group, these groups of a population. But the FDA will often say, no, you have to, because the safety is more important than taking one extra sample of 5 milliliters from the subject.
Well, it's going to be interesting to find out or see where you end up finding yourselves and which studies you end up sort of managing down the line, George. So we'll be paying close attention to that. Now, look, I often ask, people about their plans. I guess, you've already covered what the plan is and how what you're looking to achieve with Molecule to Market. What do you think has perhaps been the biggest challenge you've faced so far, or perhaps you are still continuing to face? Because that would be interesting to know, because again, anyone else looking to, form a CRO, get started, it'd be interesting to know probably the biggest challenge that they're likely to encounter.
The biggest challenge is timing, I think, because most, even if you don't have a non-compete, when you get to that higher director level, it's kind of well known you're not supposed to go start a CRO.
How strict are the non-competes?
Well, the strictness
recruitment, they're pretty common. Well,
this is what I looked into, because I was like, this was my main worry. That everyone talks about taking a year's break before you do anything. But if you really look at it, it really comes down to just don't take any clients that you already know of or you've had connection with in any way. And then it doesn't matter, because it's all new business to you. Like, mm-hmm. No one can stop you from gaining new business. I think that the other thing I was worried about is like, and I've sort of seen this, is like, well, who will come with me? Like, who do I trust? Because you have to start these conversations early. And some people I thought were like definite shoo-ins to be like, yes, I'm gonna come with you, were a no. And other people who I was hoping they would, but wasn't quite sure, have been definitive yeses. So like that's what I've been experiencing.
Interesting. Yeah, so I mean, there's non-competes in all industries, and it's just how you get around it. But I think you've hit the nail on the head there. The key to repeat business in any line of work is new business. If you're consistently bringing in new leads, new business, you never have to worry. It's just a system. You just keep following it and do what you do. So look, I like that. And look, if in terms of how things look at the moment, where are you looking to be in the next, say, 6 months? I know there's just a handful of you at the moment. You're working remote, but what's the kind of the headcount goal within the next 6 months, 12 months, just so that we've got an idea of that before we roll on?
Definitely five people in the next 6 months. That's my goal. Hopefully I have that this quarter. We're in this quarter already. The 12-month goal would be to double that. And then eventually, I think we want to keep around the 30s. I've worked for a lot of companies. Even when I worked for PPD back in the day, we're in Melbourne. I saw our office grow from 20 to 100. Wow. And I felt like the best numbers were in the 30s, low 40s. Padeon was like that as well. And then we became 1800 when we joined Premier. I like that number. It's small enough that everyone knows each other and not large enough where you start to get clicks and things like that. We can still focus on serving our clients, our new clients, and we don't have to rely on picking up big clients just to cover headcount. So that's really like 5-year goal is to have a team of about 30-something people.
Amazing. And what will it mean to you if to achieve that? I guess, you know, you've talked about Robin and Anne backing you and you being pleased with that. You know, what would that personally mean to you? Because I guess that's what we all work for, isn't it? That kind of that self-fulfillment to an extent. Everyone's version of success is different.
Yeah.
So what would that, you know, mean?
Personally, I want to see how many people I can bring along on that journey and make us all be together in 5 years. That would be like the ultimate sense of fulfillment. We didn't touch on this, and it's probably important, is that the one thing it's difficult, one of the most difficult things is attracting people to us, to a new company. It helps that Molecule to Market's been around for a while in Australia, but we're still a new company in the US. So as a point of differentiation, it's been really important to me because I learned this getting into biotech is having equity in the company is can be career and life-changing for everyone, especially long-term if you stick to it. So if we will provide we have a plan to provide the first 30 to 35 employees with equity and build that up over 5 years. And then if we can go another 5 years and hit that next CRO life cycle where people are looking to spend some money and buy, we would be like, that'd be the ultimate goal.
It's amazing.
Build something. But everyone gets something out of it as well. It's not like I'm just trying to make money, Anne's just trying to make money, or Robin. Like, we will take everyone along for the ride with us in the US subsidiary.
I think it's a case of sharing that mission, sharing in that, you know, vision and you know, achieving a common goal. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. So look, I know that I will keep in touch and we'll, you know, document your journey and perhaps have you back on the show in the not too distant future to hear how it's all going. But look, before we let you get off, we always like to close up the show with a quick fire questions round. George, let me kick you off with our first of the quick fire questions. And that is, look, you spoke a lot about, you know, your early days and getting into research and, you know, I guess kind of looking up to your father a little bit in terms of his work ethic. But what is the one piece of advice that you would now give to your younger self?
This is a hard one because you're like, well, if I gave advice, like, does that change anything?
Would you take it? That's the thing. Yeah.
I think I narrowed it down to taking more time with the people when I first meet them, because I tend to be direct and efficient. I think it's Australian as well. But in the US, I've heard it along, and I know this is a quick fire round, but a lot of people from work who have met my wife have said to her, I thought George hated me at the beginning. Like, she's so quick and direct with all the questions I asked her. So that's definitely something I would take, and I think that's a good piece of advice for my younger self.
I like it. Well, I didn't feel that way. If it's any consolation, when you and I first jumped on a call, I felt very, very pleased to meet you, George. So doing well.
Good. And likewise, I think you're charming, George. So what is the number one book or resource that you would recommend for our audience? Anything that you have on your bedside at the moment?
I've had a book there for 3 years. Not getting read. So my number one resource, especially if you're traveling, is a fully charged power bank, because, like, you will need it. Like, just have a backup source of power for all your gadgets.
CRA life still getting him, you see,
still in there.
Yeah, I like it. And look, you know, you're currently in the process of looking to build out the business, take people on. Of course, you're going to network amongst you know, people that, you know, we all like to do that. But what would you say are the top three qualities that you look for most in people, you know, and people that you're, you know, you're going to take on externally?
One of my favorite ones is uniqueness. It's actually a favorite interview question that I think I've come up with, because I've never heard of anyone asking it. Is I always ask candidates, what's a unique skill they can bring to the team? Because I feel like if they add a unique skill, the overall value and the variety of what the team can provide increases. So that's really significant. Number two is a term from Padeon. They coined the phrase lunchable. So like when you go to lunch or on a work trip with someone you work with, the time you're spending outside of work doesn't feel like work because you just enjoy spending time with them. And then for like the managers I'm looking at is people who are focused on managing their team more than managing their superiors or milestones. Like if you manage your team really well, you can deliver anything that a client wants or anything that senior management wants. So people that are focused on managing their team.
I like it. I particularly like that lunchable one.
That's a new one for us. That's great. Yeah. What is your favorite thing outside of work, George? I think you may have given us a couple of clues, but I'd love to hear it from you.
James and I are so alike. Definitely, like, other than family, because, like, family is it. But for me, it's running. Just any sort of exercise that gets me outdoors, gives me that mental stability. And if I can get outdoors, the vitamin D to be able to get out in the sun.
Awesome.
Awesome. Adam's got a couple of marathons under his belt as well, George. He's also in that club.
Four, but I'll tell you what, it was a long time ago. Long time ago. My waistline would not speak to a marathon runner's physique these days.
And look, George, to wrap us up, more of a deeper, meaningful one. Look, finally, what would you rate as your number one golden rule for both life and business?
I think I didn't realize life and business. I think answering people's questions, like there really isn't a silly question. People, like, you don't know, like they might not have come across it. And this is like something I'm always trying to get better at, is like take the time to answer it. My one little thing is my quirkiness is, so if I do take the time to answer the question, this is probably more on the business side. I hope the person remembers it and doesn't ask me again. Like, I don't care really what the question is. I will take the time to teach you and answer it once, but just once only. I don't like to do it the second time.
I like that. We've heard that a few times, kind of, you know, don't be afraid to speak up. But then when you do speak up and you get the answer, make sure that you're not just speaking up, you're listening up, if that's a real phrase.
It should be, because it's everyone does. People don't realize, like, even if you don't have the experience, ask the question, because it might give those other people something they haven't heard before and they can think of it differently. Like, yes, we are in the industry, but who knew how well, like, decentralized trials would take off? Like, a few people did in 2019 and they were in a really good spot when COVID hit, but a lot of people didn't. So.
No, interesting. Well, look, George, as I said, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on with Adam and I on the Huxley Morton podcast. Look, before we let you go, for anyone that is looking to reach out to you, the Molecule to Market team, read more about you, etc., what is the best way to get hold of you?
Probably our website is molecule2.com. So quite simple.
And that's the digit two, isn't it?
Digit two, yes, yeah. I like my email address now because I don't have to spell my last name, which I have to do a lot of in the US. So it's george@molecule2.com and LinkedIn. Just I'm sure we're connected on LinkedIn, so anyone who's connected with you can reach out to me.
We'll hook you up there. Well, look, George, thanks again for being a guest, and I will let you get off to enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you guys for having me.
Great to meet you, George. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.